today because it is a holy time. So we had a great holy time, did Kath and I. She put me to work. I was telling Kara that I had to come back to work in order to rest from my vacation, my holiday. But one of the projects we did along the way, we built a walk. Before it was a patio. This year we bought a pallet of stone and, you know, some of the big flagstones. And then you have to figure out how to put them together. They go together in some form like a mosaic, I suppose, but you build a walkway, and that was quite a project. And I think I probably put in 60 hours. I hope it looks good, and I hope it stays and settles and doesn't heave with the winter frost. We'll see if I did it right, but it looks pretty good for now. How do I know? Because Kath gave me the thumbs up. So it's great to be back. Well, I don't know about you, but there are times in my life... Well, I think about William. I was listening to your story about the jet, and I don't know that it was misplaced. I don't know that it was forgotten. You just moved on. You got older. Age happened. Life occurred. And somewhere along the way, the jet disappeared. But I know that many of us have lost things along the way. How many of you have lost things, things that were really valuable, especially when you were a child? They were incredibly meaningful, more so and perhaps all out of proportion to the intrinsic value of the object. But you lose something because there's a connection with it. It means something beyond the value of the product or the commodity itself. I think we've all lost things. And if you ever have, then perhaps you'll be able to relate to this story today. I want to take you to 2 Kings. And on this particular day, Elisha, who was a disciple of Elijah, who was his master before. Elisha has become the chief of all the prophets, but gathered around him is a community of prophets who live with their families as well. And they came under the protection, under the wing, under the leadership of Elisha. And it got crowded in their community, so they were going to build and expand. So they came to Elisha, said, "Do you mind if we go down by the river? We'll cut some logs." This is where timber frame homes come from, log cabins, I suppose. They weren't original with Abraham Lincoln, and I don't suppose this is where they really began. But that's what they were going to do. They were going to cut logs in order to build homes for themselves. This is their story. The company of the prophets said to Elisha, "Look, the place where we meet with you is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan River, where each of us can get a pole, a log, and let us build a place there for us to live." And he said, "Go." He gave them permission. Then one of them said, "Won't you please come with your servants? They're so polite here." "I will," Elisha replied, and he went with them. Then they went to the Jordan and began to cut down trees. As one of them was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. "Oh, my Lord," he cried out, "it was borrowed." That makes it even worse. Not only has he lost it, but it had been borrowed, and he was unable to return it. The man of God asked, "Where did it fall?" When he showed him the place, Elisha cut a stick and threw it there and made the iron float. "Lift it out," he said. Then the man reached out his hand and took it. I'm wondering if that's what God has for us today, that some of us have misplaced things of great value. Some of us have lost things. Perhaps we feel as if we have lost our place in life. And I'm wondering, it's that last verse to which God drew my attention, but late in the process of developing a message for today. And I'm just wondering if perhaps some of you may have lost something. And I'm wondering if God is saying to some of us, reach out and take it, what I have for you. I believe God is the author and the finisher. Those things that we have lost or set aside, laid aside, God knows where they are. The dreams that we thought had disappeared and were gone forever, perhaps not. Perhaps they're held, protected, and guarded in the heart of God. So if there's some dream that you've been holding on to, if there's something broken, misplaced, something that's been lost, I wonder if God could be saying to us today, reach out and take what I have for you. I wonder. Well, this spring, I was down on my workbench, and we had some trees to cut once again, and I pulled out my old felling axe, and I noticed that the head was just a little bit wobbly. It wasn't tight on the axe. Sometimes I'll take the axe and I'll put it in water, and you do that in order to make the handle expand just a little bit, and then you can pound the head down, make it a little bit tighter if you're talking about a wooden handle. But I noticed it was loose, and I didn't want to lose it like one of the prophets with Elisha. But I also couldn't use it, I feared to do so, without fixing it and making the proper repair to the axe. It was way too dangerous to swing the axe without doing something to the handle. So when I was thinking about this particular passage today, I was remembering that I had to make those repairs to the axe this spring. And I was thinking about the poor prophet, like, oh, this poor man, he lost something that was important to the entire community. And I thought how easily that could happen to any of us. Worse still for him, the axe that he was using had been borrowed. I don't know about you, but have you ever borrowed something from somebody and then lost it or broken it and you couldn't give it back to them? And that's not a good feeling. Not only did the job just get a whole lot harder, but now you have to explain to them, well, it's complicated, and explain to them what happened. In all likelihood, when we read this story or hear this story, we say, what's the big deal? What do you think, John? You hear this story about somebody losing an axe head, and what do you think? Big deal. He lost an axe. Go buy a new one. Go get yourself a new axe. Well, that's easy for us to say, but I don't know where the Obishans were in those days. It wasn't quite so easy for them. I think probably if we are finding ourselves saying that, saying something like that, then it perhaps betrays our ignorance. Because not only was this axe borrowed, but did you hear it was also made of what? Iron. And what do you know about iron? Iron was rare. It was precious. It was valuable. If you look at the earliest translations and some of the older translations in the original Hebrew here, it actually says the iron fell into the water. It doesn't even say axe. It's implied the axe head, but it says the iron fell into the water. So that should give us some clue, some hint as to the value of this axe head. Other translations have expanded to clarify the meaning. The New King James Version translates it this way. It says the iron axe head, just for the sake of clarity. And some translations just omit the word iron altogether. It's just assumed. They simply omit it and say the axe head fell into the water. But I think that word iron is important. Now, some of us, you hear this story and you say, so what? We're not really all that impressed. But you know what? William, I have a story too. When I was just 12 years old, I got something that I wanted. And Cass said, don't you dare take this. But I said, I'm taking it anyway. So I brought this old axe. And this is an axe I've had since, as nearly as I can tell, since I was 12 years old. So don't do the math, okay? Don't tell me how old it is. But this was a gift from my father, and you might, very old. Yeah, it's not stone, though, so it's not quite that old. It actually is steel, probably, and not iron. So it was incredibly valuable. It was something that I wanted. And what I liked about it was that when my father gave it to me, it implied that I was ready for initiation into an adult world. Why? Well, because an axe is dangerous. It's sharp. You could hurt yourself, which is more likely than hurting somebody else, but you can get hurt with it unless you know how to use it and unless you're taught what to do with it. So I was pretty excited. An axe of my own, like my dad. That's great. So, well, could I borrow you, Harold, for a second? Now imagine an axe to grind. Oh, thank you, William. And I'm not asking him to bend over. No, I'm not. If you wanted to use the axe, I was taught that there's a certain way to do that. If you were asking for the axe and I were to give it to you, you see, I don't pass it this way to you. I hold it from the side and I hold it with the handle up. But you see, I'm not letting go. I only let go when I hear him say,
got it.
Thank you. Thank you. And then I know that you have it and it's safe for me to let go. So thank you, Harold. Thank you. Thank you for working with me. Learning how to use something that's dangerous and threatening. So thanks, Harold, for working with me on that one. You know, axes were quite valuable. They might not seem that impressive to us, but these were high technology in those days and those times. They were rare. And some of you may know how to weld, but can I ask you a question? How many of you know how to smelt your own iron? Nobody here does that? Gee, I wonder why. So you have to depend upon somebody else for at least some of the things that you need in your life. Some of us can weld, but we might not know how to smelt iron. So all that I can tell you is that axes at one time were pretty high-tech and pretty rare. And before they ever became iron or steel, they were made out of bronze, they were made out of copper, they were made out of stone. And then you come to this story that we read about in 2 Kings. And here it's a story, and there's this whole miracle thing that takes place. The axe gets lost. It falls to the bottom of the pool there. It's at the bottom. It's lost in the dark water somewhere. And then along comes Elisha, and he knows where to look, and he brings it, and he floats it back to the surface. And what do we say? Whoopee. Big deal. We're impressed with our technology, but not with theirs. We're impressed with our technology. Think of all the technology that's available in your cell phone. Incredible. Some of us can still remember, Frank, the Commodore 64. Some of us can still remember those. Today, amazing. You have more technology in your cell phone than we can possibly imagine or even use. Or what do you say about the Hubble telescope? Astonishing. Or the flyby at Pluto recently and the photographs being sent back to Earth. How many years ago was this launched? Like 9 years ago or more? Not even sure the right number. Or think about the power that we have. Only in the 20th century now can we do it. Enough nuclear power to actually destroy the entire planet. Now that's impressive. So over against that, finding an axe head and making it float to the surface, well, I don't know. We're not really very impressed with that, even if it does float. And I suspect we're not very impressed because we can make iron float, can't we? We can make steel float. Call it a boat. Call it a submarine. We know how to make iron things float. We don't need God today to float our boats. There are other ways that we can do that. So we think about stories like this, and we think about what we do today routinely, normally, day in, day out. And you hear this story, and you're just not that impressed. It's not much of a miracle by modern-day standards. And I think some of us would like to look at Elijah, the man of God, and say, is that it? That's all you got? Impress me, man of God. But there is something about this story that is impressive, but not to everyone. I found one old Bible commentator looking through some old commentaries, and one of them found this story to be humorous and amusing, and he described the story as trivial and insignificant and was apologizing for its inclusion in the Bible. And I thought, that's kind of presumptuous to call it trivial and insignificant. I suppose back in the day, however, people were impressed with an iron axe. Not only was it highly technological, but to have an iron axe was a lot easier than using a hand stone axe. And so you hear this story, and I just want to say this. It was a miracle that occurred on that day. And I don't know about you, but are you impressed with miracles? I still am. I don't even know how to judge if there's a small miracle or a large miracle. How do you know if it's small? How do you know if it's large? In our eyes, it may not be all that significant, but in the eyes of the person whom it affected, I think it's extremely significant and far from trivial. So how do you judge between a small miracle and a large miracle? A miracle is a miracle is a miracle. It's still a gift, a mystery of God presented in a moment of need. It's a miracle. So think about this then. Since when does iron float? Well, if you were living in the time of Elisha, the answer is when God gets involved. That's when iron floats. And I don't know if this is a big miracle or a small miracle, but it is a miracle. After all, let me ask you a question. Can you do this? Can you make iron float? Sure you can. Anybody have a magnet? Oh. Now, there's no evidence here. I'm not explaining it. Don't say that. It was something that God revealed to me. He said, so, Jeff, do you have a magnet? So, you see, it could be done. There are ways to do it, other ways that we might know and think about today. But I just simply want to say to you that this was indeed a wonder, and it was mysterious and miraculous. And it was all so very important for one man, one poor, pitiful prophet. Think about him and his plight. Oh, no, I lost it. Oh, no, we need this. Oh, no, it's borrowed. Man of God, Elisha, Master, what are we going to do? All I could tell you is it mattered to him. And if it matters to just one person, then it matters to the man of God. So if you came in here today, and perhaps you suffered some kind of loss, perhaps something is broken, perhaps there's something that you've been yearning to retrieve that you're still looking for, I simply want to say to you that God knows exactly where it is, what you're looking for, and He knows where you are, and I want to say that it matters to Him. Thank goodness Elisha cared enough to get involved. And he used his power, the power that he had for good, to help out one in need. Maybe we do the same. You ever do that? You ever stop to notice what's going on in the world around you, one individual? And that maybe that's what God is all about. Stooping to find out why a child is crying. Did you ever stop when you see a child alone crying? What's wrong? Did you ever stop when you see somebody begging? Maybe it's on Church Street looking for a little loose change. Did you ever stop and engage in conversation to find out what might be going on? What about a coworker sitting in the lunchroom all alone, looking lost or forlorn, solemn? Do you ever stop and say, everything okay? How's it going? Do we ever take the time to look and to notice and then to help? I think when we see this story in the Bible, I know it may not seem like the most compelling of stories, but I think we need to take it on its own terms, and we need to take it seriously. It's here, it's in the Scriptures, and if we take the Scriptures seriously and regard highly the authority there, then I think it's important that we contend with it. It's here. Somebody else may say, well, it's trivial and insignificant, but it is here, and I think it's important for us to take it on its own terms. After all, if you've ever read 2 Timothy 3:16, and I wish I had made this a memory verse, John. Maybe I'm going to make it a memory verse this week. But you've heard that particular passage. All Scriptures are inspired by God and profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, and training in righteousness in order to adequately equip the man of God for every good deed. I'm going to get that verse down by the end of the week if I can. I wish that were one of my memory verses, but it says all Scripture is God-breathed, inspired by God, in order to equip us for good works. And that's exactly what Elisha embodies. Are we so arrogant, you and I? Are we so puffed up, so impressed with our own ability and our own technology that we think that there's nothing here for us today? We hear this and we go, ho-hum, big deal, you made an axe head float to the surface. Do we dare discount and minimize what God would magnify and memorialize? I wonder. Do we minimize what we see there, or do we take it seriously? Because once upon a time, an axe represented the power of God, the authority of God. I went back and did just a little bit of research, and I don't want to bore you, and Avery will probably like this, but, axes used to be made out of stone, flint or greenstone, or they used to be made out of slate, and they were hand axes, and they didn't have handles. Later, they learned to attach a handle. Why? Because you get a whole lot more leverage than just moving with your hand. It brings you a whole lot more energy and impact to the job. So they learned how to attach handles made of wood, antler, bone. And after that, they began to drill holes in the stone and attach them. And then they discovered bronze, and they made them out of bronze and copper between about 5,000 and 3,000. But there's something about bronze that's kind of brittle, and it can break. So when you learn how to smelt iron, then you've got something really significant. I also learned that in Sweden, it was a cultic symbol, the axe was. It was a symbol representing even the deity itself. So if you had an axe, people understood, oh, you're talking about the power of God. What's one of the Marvel comic characters? Thor? What's he carry? A hammer, and a big hammer. But you know, axes can be used to hammer as well. I think that's not insignificant. And you can see there, even today, some of the parallels, how important they were. During the 19th century, the rise of industrialization, there was a great demand for axes because we were clearing the land and felling trees. And so as the demand grew, people moved into production, and it began to be standardized and uniform because that brought the production cost of an axe down. And I also read this. I wouldn't have known this. I can't say that it's accurate, but this is what I read. In 19th century Maine, the double axe, the one pictured on the bulletin, reappeared. It had been used wisely right up until about the first century or before, but then it kind of went out of popularity. But in the 1840s or so in Maine, it reappeared. I think I can understand why. what I didn't know, and this isn't going to sound nice, they called it a Methodist axe. Do you know why they called a double-edged axe a Methodist axe? Because they said it was, as I said, it's not going to be too nice here. They said because Methodists were two-faced. Didn't say it was nice. I don't understand why or what that means, but they called it the Methodist axe. You can just forget that now. Delete that one, okay? So an axe of iron was a special tool, and it was of special significance, especially for the servants of Elisha. And so that day, when this poor, pitiful prophet, when he lost the axe head, it was important, and I imagine he was desperate. Not only was it irreplaceable, but he could probably not have afforded it as well. Why do you think it was borrowed? Not everybody had an iron axe head. Alas, master, it was borrowed. Remember Dagwood Bumstead and his neighbor Herb Woodley? Remember those two? Borrowing tools from one another? Yep. Here's your axe back, Dagwood. Sorry about the handle. I can just imagine how it would go for them. So Elisha comes in, and what does Elisha do? Well, he saves the day. And it's interesting how he does it. He takes a stick and floats it in the water. Now, if you wanted to try, and I did read some scientific explanations how this could be made to work, I'm just wondering if on an old kind of legendary, superstitious level, it might be that the stick was sort of calling out to the head, come find me, we belong together. Don't know, but I can imagine in a world where there was mystery and magic and it was hard to tell where one stopped and the next began, that they might have moved in that direction. But that's not what we are to understand. We're to understand that the man of God got involved, and maybe that was the real miracle. It wasn't how it happened, but that it happened, and that he engaged and got involved. What might have seemed like a relatively minor domestic incident was something that mattered to God. It mattered to the servant, and so it mattered to Elisha as well, the man of God. And maybe that's the profoundly simple point here. You look at this story and go, so what, Jeff? Well, maybe the very simple point of the story is that God is profoundly interested in our daily, ordinary lives. In the common domestic routine, you get up, you go to bed, you go to work, you fix meals, you wash the dishes, you mow the lawn. In the midst of all those things, God is there to be found. And God is even nearer at a time of need, when something breaks, when something is lost, when something doesn't go the way that we want, and we start to question or say, oh no! At that very point, God is close at hand. All I can say is that after reading this, it seems to me that nothing is lost on God. Nothing. God specializes in lost causes. So if you think that's the story of your life, I'm a lost cause. I couldn't possibly please God. Why doesn't God hear my prayers? I want to say to you, are you sure about that? Take a moment. Read this story. Yes, he does. God does care. He especially looks at those humanly hopeless causes. And God is deeply engaged. Nobody goes missing. Nothing goes missing without God noticing and detecting and knowing where to look. And I think God sometimes, however, waits for us to ask for help. He waits for us. And so here's Elisha listening. And the servant says, oh no, master, not only is it gone, but it's also borrowed. And then Elisha swings into action. All I can say is that after this story, these things that we think may be coincidence, accidental, or left to chance, not with God. It's not just a coincidence, but it's all about God's providence. God certainly knows how to refloat your boat and mine. God wants to be a helper to us, I believe, to all the lost endeavors, the lost hopes and dreams that some of us have misplaced. God would love to restore them, to finish what God has started in our lives. So it's no matter if the causes to which we subscribe seem lost, I don't think that they're lost on God. Nothing is too small, nothing too trivial. And know this too, there is no problem in our lives that's too great for God. No detail too small, no problem insurmountable or too great. Can you accept that? From beginning to end, there's nothing too small or too tall, nothing too great for God to do. I believe that we have, you and I, a God who majors in the minors, who cares about the details. We have a God who is willing to engage and to help us. And size is not the issue. Sometimes it's not the size of our problems, and while this may not seem very big to us, I guarantee that for that poor prophet, This was a big problem. Oops, we have no more axe, or I lost it. It was valuable. We'll never be able to pay this back. Oops. But it's not about the size of the problems that we have. Isn't it about the size of our God? When Doug Hoffman was here from Kids Alive, I think he said something. He said, sometimes, you know, we talk to God about the size of our problems, but I believe it's about time for us to talk to our problems about the size of our God. There is too big or too insignificant or trivial for God to care about or to want to get involved. Some of us think God is only involved on the big days, when you need to bring down the walls of Jericho, when you need to save us from the pursuing enemy and separate the waters. That's when we cry out to God. Well, not this one. The prophet is just, oops, lost the axe. And he cried out, and he knew what to do. Master, help. It's as simple as that. How many of you know the story about the widow's mite? She gave all that she had. It may have only been a couple pennies, and it may not have seemed like much, but in God's eyes, it was more than enough. How many of you know Jesus told stories, parables about mustard seeds and about yeast? Yeast is pretty tiny, but it multiplies and leavens the entire lump, the way Jesus tells us. Jesus was so bold as to call his disciples the little ones. So don't think that God doesn't take an interest in our little lives, little ones. And where two or three are gathered together, that's all it takes, Jesus is saying. That's all it takes. That's enough for him to get started. Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am too. One, two, three. Okay, we're done. We have enough people for God to be here, for Jesus to show up. That's all it takes. That's all it takes. So just when you thought something was broken, lost, or misplaced, I want to say to you that God is ready, standing there alert, saying, okay, what do you want me to do? Where did you lose it? Let's go together and see where it happened. Let's see where it started. And so perhaps God is best revealed when we come to those moments of crisis. We go, oh no, I don't know what to do about this. Well, where we end and our ability stops, what I would say to you is that's where the ability of God takes over. That's where he's just rolling up his sleeves to get started. Where you come to your end of your resources and say, uh-oh, it's gone down there. No way to get it back. That's where God says, well, let me have a look at it. I think I know what to do here. But there are a couple things that we need to do. At least the servant of God knows enough to say, Master. He knows who to consult, who to ask for help. And he does. Master. And worse still, it was borrowed. And then I'm going to challenge you with a little homework, because I think God is ready to help. But after Elisha floats it back to the surface, it's the verse 7 there, he tells his servant, he tells the prophet to do this. He says, reach down and take it. Just because he's floated it back to the surface, the servant still has something to do. He has to reach down and pick it up for himself. I believe that God has miracles for us, that God knows where are the dreams that we've set aside, the things that have been displaced and lost. I believe that God still wants to float the boats of some of us. How many of you would like your boat to be refloated? You have that sinking feeling? That's okay. God knows where to look. But when it comes to the surface, you need to be ready and poised, prepared to reach out and take what he has for you. In fact, I really believe all you need to do is start by opening your heart and opening your hands and say, Lord, I want to receive whatever you have for me. I think I need this, but you know what I really need. And until I've heard from you, I haven't heard the last word. Some of us have given up. Some of us have given out. Some of us have just given our problems over. But I believe we have a God who is willing and ready to hear us just say, Master, I'm ready to receive what you have for me. Are you ready to receive? Let's pray.